Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
We're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From beautiful downtown Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, Maddie and I play talent agents as we pitch hard for our top five up-and-coming actors.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Dick Prawl, and the third film in our Pedro Almodovar marathon, All About My Mother.
But first, Film Spotting considers Canada or Mexico with Ryan Phillippe in Stop Loss.
Brandon Leonard King.
Yes.
You have orders to report to the 1st Brigade.
Not me. I'm getting out today.
You leave on the 22nd, shipping back to Iraq. You've been stop lost.
Get up, get out, get away from these liars, cause they don't get your soul.
I ran over 150 combat missions, no complaint.
I honored my contract, and I expect the Army to do the same.
What the hell's happened to these guys?
With a shortage of guys and no draft, they're shipping back soldiers who're supposed to be getting out.
Maddie, Stop Loss director and co-writer Kimberly Pierce, whose previous film was Boys Don't Cry, was just on Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. And in setting up the interview, Mr. Anderson talked about the spate of recent Iraq War theme movies and their failure to connect with audiences. He mentioned a couple decent films, and he said they were decent films as well, In the Valley of Ella, Grace is Gone, and they did very little at the box office. He also mentioned Brian De Palma's Redacted, which I know you didn't get a chance to see, and you should be thankful for it because it's terrible, which Mr. Anderson also correctly noted. So we know why that film maybe didn't connect. It's a really bad movie, but he also then wondered, is it going to be kind of like with Vietnam, where it's going to take a little bit of time? We're going to have some perspective to really get that good batch of Iraq War movies. It's going to be 5-10 years down the road from now, and then we'll really see the best crop of movies, and we'll see audiences finally connect with it. Maybe right now it's still a little too raw for anyone to really want to dive into it. And I was recently watching an episode of Bill Maher where his guest was a reporter stationed in Iraq. And he was asked how the soldiers feel about the fact that Americans seem to be totally disinterested in the war. And he responded that something like only 4% of news coverage these days is devoted to Iraq. And the soldiers are very aware of that fact, that there is this Iraq fatigue, but that it doesn't really matter because they understand what their duty is. And at the end of the day, what they're fighting for is the guy next to them for their buddies. And we certainly see this played out in Stop Loss. This is probably an unfairly loaded question, but what I want to know from you is whether Kimberly Pierce gives us the movie these soldiers deserve, and could it go down as a rare war-themed movie that got it right while still in the midst of its conflict?
No. You and I have seen actually some films that did work. We saw American Soldier, I think renamed to The Recruit at Sundance, which really, really does justice to the men and women serving now in our armed forces. And also we both saw Taxi to the Dark Side and No End in Sight, some great documentaries. But you're right, the dramatic narratives right now are not up to snuff. I just have to say, about halfway through this film, I turned to you and I said, I would pay this film $10 if it just ended now. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't being facetious, and I broke one of our cardinal rules. We go to extreme measures not to give away our reviews or our reactions to a film while we're watching the movie simultaneously.
That's true.
But you actually outdid me.
I did.
As we were leaving the theater, do you remember what you said?
I said something like, I feel like we've just been stop lost.
Yes. And I think it might surprise our audience to learn that you and I actually don't like to revel in a film's misery.
We do not
hope that a film stinks when we review it. One of the perks of this show is that we're not bound to review every film that comes down the pike. We can pick and choose what we want. I go in with the same mindset when I teach a theater class. Someone brings their work in to be shown, you praise what works, you work with them on it, and then you give them notes on what they can improve on. I'm not that clever to, sit around and come up with puns on why a
Starkey
film stinks.
Responses.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I'm trying to be as honest as possible. People interpret that as harsh. Of course, we get several emails on that. But it's actually just the school I come from, and it's always meant to be constructive. So, all that said, here's what I liked about this little film.
Fantastic. Can't wait.
Iraq. I like the scenes in Iraq.
The war scenes.
I thought they were extremely well done. I thought they sort of put me right in that situation with those guys. It had me wondering, did you think this, how you would operate if you were a sentry at one of those Iraqi checkpoints?
Yeah.
My God. I mean, the horror that these guys have to live through. And I thought she did a great job of showing that. And that's the operative word. She showed that. She showed that reality. She showed that horror. And then she spends an hour and a half telling us about that horror, much to the detriment of the film. This film doesn't move at all. It has a great premise. I mean, okay, think about it. You're being sent back to the front against your will. Doesn't have to be the Iraq War. Could be any war. I could, in a half hour right now, go write you a treatment about, you know, by God, what are you going to do? You're going to run to Canada. You're going to fight.
And you're a good patriot. You're a good soldier
exactly,
on top of it.
Exactly. That's a great film. Unfortunately, what we get here is an after-school special. This thing is terribly and grossly written, and it's full of predictable stereotypes. In the end, whatever this film is trying to say about stop-lossing in today's armed forces is completely, completely undone by the film's construction. Its desire to tell ad nauseum over showing.
Yeah, you're right. This movie really is not good, and it is true. We don't sit there while we're watching a movie. We rarely actually get to see movies together.
Right.
It's less than half the time. But even after the film, we don't get together on the phone and talk about these movies. We want it to be fresh when we sit here. In this case, you turned to me at one point and said, yeah, I'd pay it $10. It just so happened that at that point that you said that, the movie then took a turn for the worse in a way I never could have imagined. Like, literally, you picked the scene that then made the movie unbearable in
a
way.
It was a really
we'll
sort of,
about
it was a dark and sort of hopeless time. And I'm like, all right, they're sitting in a bar. If the credits roll right now, I'm going to walk away thinking about something at least, you know?
Right. But then we get the next scene and it just took it to a whole nother gross level and literally gross. And then I was just like, no, really, I'd pay it 20 or 50.
Yeah.
I wanted it to stop at that point. What I liked about the movie, Kimberly Pierce's heart is so in the right place here. She's telling stories that we don't get to hear about. There is that Iraq fatigue. We're seeing the toll that the war takes on these young men when they get back to civilian life. And without hitting us over the head, we do see in some instances how these guys can actually prefer being in Iraq over being back in the States, because it's so hard to acclimate themselves back into the chaos of normal life. Despite the chaos going on in Iraq, there's at least some kind of order to things. There are certain rules you play by. You stay alive. You protect the guy next to you. There's a certain structure to it. The demands on normal life in many ways are more complicated. And I think the way she explores that is really interesting. And we see how these guys can't deal with it.
What scene particularly? Because there is one that I really like.
No, I don't know. There's a lot that I like. The problem is they all start to blend together. I can't single one out because the structure of this movie then becomes literally a string of scene of soldiers drinking or shooting their guns at stuff and getting into trouble, followed by a scene of poorly written dialogue, people talking about the war, followed by a war flashback scene, followed by a soldier freakout scene. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Mm-hmm. It becomes so redundant. And some of the freakout scenes where they're having those flashbacks, they feel really forced. And then the movie wastes time becoming kind of a road movie.
Oh, that's terrible.
And there were so many instances where I was just saying to myself, really, Kimberly Pierce, this is the most effective use of your narrative time here. We've got this great conflict. You exactly said it. We've got this amazing story, this examination of conscience here, where we've got a guy really struggling with, he's done his duty. Ryan Phillippe's character, Brandon King, he's been a great soldier, a staff sergeant. He loves his fellow soldiers, some of them from his hometown. He is good at what he does. He's been there for 2 years. They want to send him back for a third. He thinks that's wrong. And of course, he's right that that's wrong, this backdoor draft. Do you let your buddies down? Do you, quote unquote, let your country down by not going back? Or do you go back even though it's wrong? There's a great conflict there. Unfortunately, nobody is really given anything more than a cookie cutter sort of framework. You get no real sense of who these people are, and that's too bad because you have some really talented young actors here. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Channing Tatum is his buddy, Abby Cornish, Kieran Hands, our boy Kieran Hands is the father who seems to be in everything these days. None of those people are giving anything to do but be one-dimensional.
No, I think you're right. It's sort of, you know, Varsity Blues meets the war.
It is.
It really sort of unfortunate. The one scene that I did really like, and it involved Joseph Gordon-Levitt and his character, was when he used the wedding gifts as target practice. I'm not giving anything away. It happens very early on in the movie. That scene was so specific. It captured a bunch of Texas guys the night after a binger. And again, it showed the toll that their service had taken on them, how they were beginning to deteriorate.
And the relief, real quick, if I can add, the relief of them getting to go back and sort of, in a way, recreate Iraq. They were just home. They were with their families, and it was a nightmare. They all got drunk and got into fights, and everyone gets mad at them.
Right.
They then get to escape out on their own to the ranch and be guys again.
Yeah,
and they
exactly.
Love it.
And you know, if we'd gotten more scenes like that, just sort of beautiful, specific scenes. Unfortunately, she just force feeds us cliche after cliche after that. The only other thing that I did like about this film, and I think I whispered this to you during the film, was the fact that one of the characters was named Shriver, and he's a sergeant. And if you
think that was by design.
I'm hoping it's by design. Okay. I hope it's not just a happy accident. Because if you know anything about Sergeant Shriver and his real relationship with the U.S.'s involvement in World War II and America First, well, it's a really sort of that's a neat, clever way of indoctrinating sort of the MTV generation into that history. I think that's really neat, and I'm going to give it credit for that if it happened.
Okay. Well, it could be a coincidence. It could not. I think I agree with you there, but. What's really tough about criticizing this film, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is that I know Pierce, based on hearing this interview, she has a brother. She had a brother who was in the war, who went through a situation very similar to this and was the inspiration for this movie. So again, her heart is clearly in the right place, and there isn't any sense of condescension at all in the way she portrays these folks, just like there wasn't in Boys Don't Cry. But I do feel like, and I know this is maybe kind of a bold statement, maybe is a little too harsh, but I actually feel like she does a bit of a disservice to these men in the end by giving us such a hackneyed script and after-school special type story, and also by going so far with showing the mental toll that it takes on them. She kind of reduces all of these characters to just walking time bombs, and I'm not at all trying to downplay the effect of the horrors of war that it has on these men, how they come back messed up, how this is a reality for a lot of people, but I think it's got to be a little bit more complex than she shows it.
We're not criticizing the intents of the filmmakers here at all.
No.
We're just criticizing its construction. Unfortunately, that's all we have to go on. When you leave this theater, you don't feel moved in any way, and that's a valid criticism, no matter what they were trying to go for.
Yeah, and that scene that we mentioned is the one where I couldn't believe then it went in a whole other direction of grossness is really the scene where he goes to a hospital to visit one of his soldiers who got hurt in the scene we see at the beginning of the film. And I know what she's trying to do there. She's literally trying to shove the horror of war in our face. We get extreme close-ups of this guy who is missing an arm. He's missing a leg. He's blind. His face is all burned. He looks terrible. And I understand that she is trying to, I think, battle that Iraq fatigue. She's saying, look, you want to ignore the war? I'm going to make you look right at it. But it felt so gratuitous and wrong. I felt like it was exploitative in some way, and it unnerved me in a way that I know maybe she was going for, but again, it just felt to me like it was so forced that in the end it actually ends up undoing what she's trying to do. It makes you recoil from it, and it doesn't have the effect that she wants. It didn't for me anyway.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's really unfortunate. This movie is not an Iraq war. When I left the theater, I certainly didn't have any feelings about the war when I left.
No, it doesn't explore it, I think, in really an intelligent way at all. And the style of it, too. I think we just at least have to mention that the homemade videos, she's trying to match those a little bit, that you see a lot of these soldiers do produce. You can see them on YouTube, and this was something she saw her brother watching, and so that was kind of the inspiration there. She's trying to match that in a way with some of the editing, with the close-ups, with the graininess of it, but it just didn't work for me. There's not a whole lot of sophistication to the framing of what you're getting, and I understand that that is what she's going for, but I feel like you either have to go for it completely and literally give us like an MTV-style home shot soldier movie, or make it kind of this epic war film and give us Texas on this grand scale. But I didn't really feel like what she ended up doing was that interesting. The close-ups were just brutal. I mean, ugly in this case, and they didn't add anything to the drama for me to be an inch from their faces. And the end, by the end of the film, you're right, you talk about being unmoved. Actually, I felt tricked. She didn't convince me of the decision that Brandon makes, right or wrong. She didn't convince me that it was the right decision for him. So, unfortunately, this movie, one we probably all need to see, but you just wish it could have been done better.
There's so many other movies we could recommend.
That's not what I mean. I mean literally in terms of what it's exploring. These soldiers deserve this story. They just deserve a better story.
You're right. Well, go check out Coming Home. Of course, it's a Vietnam film, but it tells that story so much better.
Well, there you have it. Stop Loss is out now in theaters everywhere. Agree or disagree with our takes? Email feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, one listener chides us for leaving Henry V off last week's top five movies that break the fourth wall. Another thanks us. The eternal struggle that is film spotting. Next in Listener Feedback. Stay with us.
Halfway to Hollywood, I'm selling songs, you're selling me good books. Taking every offer I put and down the coast of Capitol.
guys, this is Sean from Temecula. I'm calling in about the movie The Mist. It came yesterday, and I finally checked it out, and I want to thank you guys personally for recommending it. I was really surprised to see kind of the layers and with people conforming together and splitting apart due to fear and everything. I thought that was just really incredible, handled really well, and definitely a movie that will not leave me for quite a while. I've been thinking about that movie all day today. So thanks, guys, for the recommendation. And I love the show. I listen religiously every week.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. A voicemail there about The Mist, a movie we reviewed back when it came out a few months ago here on the show. Maddie, you did say it was a fun B movie. I liked it too, and it's nice to see that some of our listeners are actually checking it out.
Dude, it's in my queue.
It is in your queue. It is out now in a 2-disc special edition, so if you're curious about The Mist, it really is worth your time. It's a great rental.
It's a lot of fun.
Marcia Gay Harden going way over the top, but I think really kind of walking the line where maybe she doesn't go way over, just kind of bunches up near the line. I think she's really fun in that movie. So you can check out The Mist now, and we've got some more great feedback we're going to get into here in a moment. But first, a little bit of housekeeping, Maddie. We have to acknowledge two quick corrections. It is true, last week on the show, I did suggest that Warren Beatty directed the film Shampoo, and you wondered if it was maybe his first film that he directed. So we were obviously both wrong. Of course, that movie Shampoo was directed by the great Hal Ashby, but it is one of those films that Beatty had a hand in writing and
producing. Sort of like J.J. Abrams and Cloverfield,
maybe, right? A little bit. Getting all the credit for it, whether he deserves it or not. And I did say I think the movie's a little bit overrated. I think some of Warren Beatty's early films, the ones that he has a major role in, not just as an actor, but as a producer and director and everything, I think sometimes they're a little messy. I didn't love
Shampoo. Well, now, wait a second, because I remember when you had me on and we did our top five number two efforts from a director, I think I went with Reds because it was his second film. I think Heaven Can Wait is his first one, so
maybe so.
Which is a fine film, but Reds, come on, man, Reds.
That's a huge jump.
That's a great film.
I agree. Reds is a great film, and I said that last week on the show. Reds may be the exception in his body of work. I think that's nearly perfect. I don't really have any problems with Reds at all. Also, another correction, you said during our Chicago 10 review a few weeks ago that Abbie Hoffman was a New York guy, and I didn't challenge you because I thought you were right.
Right.
But
well,
he's not.
I did. Yeah. What I meant, New York. I mean, he was.
That's where he was living.
Where he was living. He was a part of that, you know, that culture.
Yes.
But he is from Worcester.
Gail wrote in and corrected us. Abbie Hoffman was born and bred in the heart. That's the hot of the Commonwealth. Every proud son or daughter of Worcester knows that one, Gail says. So thank you, Gail, for clarifying
that. Worcester represent.
I also do want to thank briefly Sam Smith and his buddy Matt in Nashville. I had a chance to hang out with them last weekend. I was in Nashville for about 24 hours. Sam, a great friend of the show, sends us some great feedback. Also the drummer for Ben Folds. So Sam's a really cool guy, knows his movies, and we hung out for a little bit along with Matt. Went and saw Taxi to the Dark Side. And I just want to say thanks again for allowing me to hang out. It was a good time. And also, we want to thank everyone for your top five suggestions. Last week on the show, we said we didn't really know what we were doing for this week's show. We came up with one we ended up liking quite a bit, or at least I had a lot of fun putting my list together. But we got probably 20 great top five suggestions that are really going to help us out here in the coming weeks. So
we got some really lame ones, too.
We got a few lame ones, too, but we got a lot more good ones. So you will probably hear your top five suggestion used on the show here at one point. Let's get on, Maddie, to some fun stuff here, some of our feedback, and we're only going to share a little bit of the Funny Games feedback here. Why don't you start it off with Josh from Wilmette?
And he says, hey, guys, love the podcast. Just writing to tell you that I'm so relieved that you guys got Funny Games. This movie is meant to be challenging and not easy to watch. It is meant to question why you watch violent horror movies and why you enjoy them. I think most critics are missing the point. Haneke isn't trying to glamorize the violence. The fact that this movie is manipulative is exactly the point. It is meant to be manipulative. However, Haneke clearly trusts his audience. I don't think he's saying that those torture movies are necessarily bad or that you are sick for liking them. He's just trying to make you question why you enjoy them. I also enjoyed it, and I don't think I'm a sick bastard for doing so.
No, I don't think you are, Josh, though I do think Maddie is, but we'll get into that here as we will get into more Funny Games feedback because we really got a ton of it. A lot of people weighed in on this film, some people who hadn't even seen the new version but maybe saw the original, other people who did check out Haneke's new version of his own film, and we will get into that as well as some notes from our marathons and a lot more great feedback in next week's Director's Cut podcast or After Hours. I don't know if we've decided on a name here, but basically a 15 to 20 minute edition of Film Spotting, a little little bit of extra stuff where we will dive into the stuff we couldn't fit in this week. Look for that on Tuesday by going to filmspotting.net or subscribing to our podcast.
Right. We also, last week, we got a lot of feedback on our top five movies.
That
break the fourth wall.
A topic that a lot of people really were into.
I love our listeners. Mm-hmm. Man, our mailboxes were flooded. We got this one from Alex from Canberra, Australia.
He says, "Very disappointed, boys. What about Henry V? Take your pick on the version." It would definitely be the Branagh version for me. "The prologue tells the audience that the stage is too small to hold the story and tells us we have to use our imaginations. On screen, of course, you can show what could only be imagined on this wooden O."
Well, Brett Merriman in Los Angeles, California has your answer. "Great list from both you guys. Film Spotting listeners breathe a sigh of relief that Henry V was not included. Not officially listed as penalty box, but we all know the truth." Now, also, I didn't include any Shakespeare because, come on, he wasn't writing for film. What else are you going
to
do?
You're right. Branagh has to kind of play with it a little bit if you're going to use the language there. But I think it's a respectable choice. It's certainly a movie I love, but it does sort of illustrate that struggle we go through every week here on the show where you cannot please everyone. Here you have Alex saying, "Guys, come on, I'm disappointed in you," rightfully so. And then you have Brett saying, "Thank God you didn't put Henry V on." It's really maybe a matter of
long-time listeners decision. Versus I was going to leave it off.
Okay. Well, for me, I left it off mainly because I talk about Henry V too much. But anyway, Brett, though, has a fantastic top five list here.
And he says, "Fight Club. My favorite is Ed Norton sitting at a banquet table with total strangers wiping his mouth before continuing his story about Tyler Durden, who is the table's waiter. Psycho. Two moments. The ending, referring to the police as they, then looking at the screen and you realize they is the audience. And after the shower scene, Marion reaches out to us for help and the camera pulls away slightly. There's nothing we can do. Also, JFK, after the final big speech in the courtroom, Costner looks at the camera and says, 'It's up to you.' 8.5, the whole film threatens to break the fourth wall until Anouk Amy finally looks at us and comments about her cheating husband. Isn't he wonderful? And also, the good, the bad, and the ugly. In Clint Eastwood's introduction, he gets the jump on bandits by stepping out from behind the camera. You don't realize it at first, but he breaks the fourth wall because he stands in a wide-open desert and no one saw him before he came on screen." Think about that, Brett says.
Yeah, it is a fantastic choice there. I like all of those picks. A lot of people wrote in with mentions of Fight Club. Of course, we may even get into a few of them here. Scott Hamm in Centerport, New York. "As a film editor in commercials, I will make one comment on your Rear Window note. Hitchcock's device works as you stated, but the purpose is also a technical one. I did have Rear Window, I think, is my number three pick. To show the proper point of view, the people in the building would have to look directly at the camera. To look to the side or just off the camera wouldn't have been clear to the viewer, only understanding what happened by Jimmy Stewart's reaction. It is a great piece of filmmaking, but also the only proper way to shoot the scene. Just a thought."
And he's absolutely right, because Rear Window puts on a clinic in point of view filmmaking, mm-hmm. not breaking the fourth wall.
But where you're wrong, and just so you know, I have made this argument to a former film professor of mine. He thought I was totally in the right to make the argument that, at least in the case of Rear Window, the fact is, yes, it is a point of view shot. It can only be the camera is standing in for Jimmy Stewart, but that's because Hitchcock has set up the entire film with that device. It's only right because he has decided to make the whole film about putting you in his spot. It's different than any other film where it's just a case where the camera is there and the person's talking to the camera and it's a point of view shot. I'm saying Hitchcock is doing something much bigger than that, and I think you just got to free your mind a little bit, Maddie, and understand that we're standing in as the voyeur for Jeff. The whole movie is built around that. I'm not trying to make the argument that any point of view shot is breaking the fourth wall. Yeah. That's not the case.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I talked to Sal, who works down on my currency exchange, and he agreed with me.
I'm sure he did.
Well, Vince from Wausau, Wisconsin writes in, "I'm not going to go so far as to say for shame, Maddie and Adam, because your lists were both very good." Actually, a lot of people complimented us our list this week. "But the split-second knee-jerk scene I thought of when I heard your top five topic about breaking the fourth wall was from the immortal Mel Brooks' masterwork, Blazing Saddles. Immediately following Clavon Little holding himself at gunpoint and sneaking himself to safety from the intolerant townsfolk, he says to himself, 'You are so talented.' Then turning to the camera, he quips, 'And they are so dumb.' Can we get a Maddie impersonation here?" No.
No, maybe not.
maybe not a lasting image for my favorite aficionados, but one that was certainly burned into my subconscious.
Yes, Mel Brooks came up a lot, and I am a fan of Blazing Saddles and many of those films. Robert Kenilworth Lewis in Bethesda, Maryland, wrote in and said that we had great picks, but you could have at least given an honorable mention to Brooks. He's famous for breaking the fourth wall. The top two examples of this would be the camera zooming in during a dinner scene in High Anxiety through a window, The camera zooms in too close and breaks through the window. The other example is the last 20 minutes of Blazing Saddles. Okay, all juvenile, but you know you laugh when you saw it.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, I actually meant to include him in my honorable mention last week, but I left my notes at home.
That's true.
So,
you were going completely off the top of your head there.
So I meant to include him with those road movies and so forth.
At least as an honorable mention.
Well,
let's get to one more here from Kate.
The ending of a movie that nominally takes place in Chicago and Florida, and perhaps my favorite last scene of a movie ever, Jack Lemmon's look of frustration and possibility after Joe E. Brown's refusal to be put off for any reason, including the fact that he's really a man. Of course, the ending of Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot. Kate in L.A. says Billy Wilder is her hero. This, of course, one of my favorite movies of all time, and I am put to shame that I did not include
it. How did you forget it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, actually, I do want to read one more here. I guess being Chicago guys, we at least have to read this one from Wade in Minneapolis. Let me bring you up to speed. My name is Wayne Campbell. I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Excellent. Yeah, Wayne's World isn't what you would call a highbrow film, but it would be my choice for top fourth wall movie. You can't beat Garth pulling the old what's that over there trick to avoid talking to the camera. Plus, it's a really funny and entertaining movie. I loved Wayne's World when it came out. It is a good movie, a great pick there. And we got a ton of emails that we are absolutely not going to be able to get to here. Maybe in the extra feedback show, we will. As always, if you have any feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater. And is that what you're wearing? She seems like a nice girl. Well, your sister called me. At least someone loves me. Therapists, listen up. It's all about our mothers. Oh, and Pedro Almodovar.
I like to leave a light on. I sleep in my clothes. You tried on. You're taking me on again. You're taking me on again. I sit on the porch when day breaks. With one extra bowl of cornflakes. You're taking me.
Private traps, clamped in them, and none of us can ever get out. We scratch and claw, but only at the air, only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch.
Sometimes we deliberately step into those traps.
I was born in mine. I don't mind it anymore.
Oh, but you should. You should mind it.
Oh, I do. But I say I don't.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a scene from a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with Anthony Perkins and Janet Leigh from Alfred Hitchcock's classic Psycho. Not the Gus Van Sant remake.
No, but it was a tie-in. We thought fairly clever. We got to give some credit to our assistant, Candace, who does a lot of work here on the show behind the scenes. She mentioned Psycho would be perfect, of course, tying in with Funny Games and Paranoid Park, our two reviews from last week. Funny Games, a remake of a film, and then Gus Van Sant, of course, remade Psycho. So there you go. Maddie, you scared a lot of people last week with your Anthony Perkins, including me.
Well, you know, I thought it was actually more of a Hal from 2001.
A little bit.
You know,
yeah.
I hadn't really worked on it.
Mm-hmm. No, I thought it was good.
All right. Well, Adam, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Renee Stern from Seattle, Washington. Maddie, where's Seattle?
Seattle is the Emerald City. It's in the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Wow. Very specific there.
Rains 10 months out of the year.
Mm-hmm. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
My agent's attempting to urge me towards Royal Shakespeare Company again.
Oh, splendid.
He's just had an audition for Rep.
Oh, splendid. So you're a thespian, too.
It is time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Maddie, I think all I will say, sometimes these screenplays are beloved, sometimes they're just a lot of fun.
Exactly.
And we are to have fun with this one. It, of course, does tie in some way with this show, and actually, I don't even remember how it ties in at this point. Oh, yes, I do. I got it now. It does tie into a topic discussed on this show. I started off, Maddie, you give me the action.
And action.
So, rumor has it that you went on a date with blank. I hear he's very nice.
He's all right. He kept talking about this bulimic head case he dumped over the 4th of July.
Really? Bulimic head case?
Yeah. What a loser she must be. Ow!
Sorry.
Anywho, Blank's invited me to the Hamptons for Labor Day weekend.
That's great.
You think so? I don't know. I guess I'm just scared.
Of what?
Duh, boys. I've never even gone to first base with a guy.
Haven't you ever practiced on one of your girlfriends?
Ew, no, that's gross.
It's not gross. How else do you think girls learn? Okay, face me. Now close your eyes and wet your lips.
And
scene.
Whoa.
We hope that was as disturbing for you as it was for us. Maybe the only thing creepier than your Anthony Perkins. Maddie, if you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, April 2nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit www.filmspotting.net. So, Adam, I wanted to ask you, how is Mama Kempinar doing out there in Iowa?
Well, I guess okay. I don't call her nearly enough. You're putting me on the spot.
Well, okay, well, fine. Now, you're going to meet, actually, Mama Robinson in a couple weeks.
Yes, looking forward to it.
And I think you and I can count our blessings that we are surrounded by wonderful, strong, beautiful, intelligent women in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And this world is full of them. And most of them, of course, won't give me the time of day. But you wouldn't know that by watching movies. Women in film are woefully underrepresented, but along comes Pedro Almodovar with movies like All About My Mother, which is chock full of women, strong, intelligent, beautiful, wily, devious, loving, backstabbing, and otherwise, all folded into one of Almodovar's nebulous soap operatic plots. I want to give the audience a smidgen of a plot outline. Manuela, Cecilia Roth, the great Cecilia Roth, mm-hmm. is a single mother with a past who takes her son to a performance of Streetcar Named Desire, where he is run over trying to get an autograph from two of the play's stars, which sends Manuela on a journey to Barcelona to find her son's father. But again, the plot is
secondary.
Really secondary here. At this point in the marathon, Adam, you're well acquainted with Almodovar's style. This film netted him an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, so far, do you agree with the Academy, and is this the pinnacle of our marathon?
Well, I'm going to put it back on you just for a second. You've heard my critiques of the past two films. I have liked both of them, but maybe not loved or fully embraced them. What do you think? Do you think this was my favorite film?
I think... yes, it was your favorite film.
It was my favorite film so far. And I love at the end of the film, we get who this movie is dedicated to. It's to Bette Davis, to Jenna Rollins, to Romy Schneider, to all actresses who have played actresses, to all women who act, to men who act and become women,
yeah.
to all people who want to become mothers, to my mother. Really touching stuff there at the end of this film. And I do love the fact that the movie starts with this transplant scene, or we get the transplant scene that we saw at the beginning of Flower of My Secret, where it's a scene where Manuela is playing a mom whose son is dying.
I mean, honest to God, his films, his entire canon could just be one long serial movie.
It could be, really. And she's playing this mom, and she has to deal with the doctor saying, hey, maybe you should think about organ donation, and it's a training video is what it is. But what I love is that the rehearsal of that then prepares her for the moment in real life when it happens to actually deal with it, and she does. And at the same time, we also see in that moment how different it is from the reenactment, how much more upsetting it is and how much more dramatic she is when her son is in an accident. And I think Almodovar there is obviously saying something about the power of art here, why he dedicates it to those actresses like he does at the end of the film. I think what he is saying is that they gave us something. They, through their work, they prepare us for the tragedies of life through their suffering on screen. They sacrifice just as mothers and all women do. And I think it's a really touching note and a really poignant one. And I did really enjoy this film.
Yeah, it's funny. This one almost lost me. Hmm. It really did. In the middle, the plot of this one is so far out there, you know, and these things just sort of start happening, falling into place that are almost absurdist, you know.
Not any more absurd than Live Flesh.
No. I think so, especially the one plot concerning Streetcar Named Desire, mm-hmm. where suddenly someone is pushed onto stage having never actually acted the role before. I was just like...
No, she did the role before, remember,
right,
as a younger actress.
As like a six-year-old, yeah.
No, as a 20-year-old.
I did really, really like this film. What was missing for me was the humor this time. We started to get it a little bit more at the end with this character, Agrado, mm-hmm. who is just wonderful, but sort of like...
A transvestite prostitute.
Yeah, exactly, but sort of like The Flower of My Secret, all these great supporting actors come in, and they all have these great fleshed-out stories of their own, and then they sort of disappear. And Agrado disappears for the majority of the middle of the mm-hmm. film. And that stuff with Penelope Cruz and Cecilia Roth wasn't as engaging as some of the interesting issues that he discusses towards the end of the film. But I love the cavalier and sort of nonchalant way, all at the same time, that he deals with these really weighty issues, AIDS, gender issues, all beautifully mm-hmm. you know, sort of enveloped in these people's lives.
Yeah, it really is good. And I remember reading Michael Atkinson in The Village Voice when they had the Viva Pedro retrospective in New York, and he said something really provocative, I think, and hard to argue with. And he was a little bit critical of Almodovar, and he said that basically the problem with this later batch of Almodovar films, which we are focusing on in the marathon, is that they don't really take any risks like the earlier films did. And even in a film that's dealing with pregnant nuns and transvestites and lesbians and hookers, there's nothing really scandalous about it or really subversive. It's all pretty quaint and just kind of reaffirms family values. And he says something, again, I think is really provocative, that aren't these movies in a way just kind of glorified Nora Ephron films? Really, what's the difference in the end between those kind of touchy-feely women's films? And again, I think it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I've got a great answer.
I don't understand why you have to put down Nora Ephron films. I know that
maybe
you don't
mean it that way. I took it that way.
I know you don't have the same respect, you know, for movies like Sleepless in Seattle and so forth. But actually, I really do enjoy those films.
Right. And so the question is, though, what's the difference between Sleepless in Seattle? Though there's a lot of differences in a movie like this, other than the fact that it's Almodovar and it's art house. Really, I think again that's where he's kind of challenging us with the question. I think it's a good one, but for me, the answer that I can give, and it's the best answer I can provide, is that Almodovar here does create characters who, with a few exceptions, I think are really complex and incredibly sympathetic. And like I said at the beginning of Live Flesh, with the intro to that film last week, there's a sense with the characters in this story that it could go anywhere. You really have no idea where the story is going, where these characters are going. There's no roadmap. And certainly with Hollywood films like Nora Ephron films, there is that roadmap. There is a sense of how everything is going to play out. You just don't get that here. And then I'm also just not as moved by characters in some of those Hollywood films like I was moved by Manuela here. Cecilia Roth, she really is incredible. The way I was rooting for her and all the women here, you know, nobody is written off a certain way. I think there's just so many layers to all of the characters. You've got the goody-two-shoes nun, Penelope Cruz, who we find out has a secret and all sorts of problems. You've got this transvestite prostitute who seems really sketchy and you don't even really want her around, but then she ends up being mm-hmm. a very responsible character. And the rich mom, who even gets her layers a little bit. She seems to be casting off Penelope Cruz and doesn't understand her daughter, but then she gets her little moment of redemption, too. There's just so many layers to Almodovar's films. And I also think it's interesting how you've got Tony Canto as Lola. There's a great bit of anticipation there, didn't you think, Maddie? And it's almost like Harry Lime in The Third Man, where you have a character who really is pushing the story forward in a lot of ways. The whole story revolves around this character, but we only hear people talk about the character and never actually see that person. And then until finally Lola shows up at the end.
I had completely forgotten about who Lola was.
Really?
I had completely forgotten about
the whole story.
And actually, I'm a little bit, and that actually was kind of the fun for me was the surprise when Lola shows up at the end. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit surprised that you're actually giving this away right now.
What am I supposed to be giving away? You know she's going to show up at some point.
You do?
Or he. You have to figure the whole story's building to that. That's why she goes to Barcelona.
Well, of course, that's why she goes. But the fact of the matter is it's the journey that's so much more interesting. And that's why I say I wasn't even expecting Lola to come on the scene.
I knew she'd eventually pop up. I figured she had to. But those homages to other films, and I'm not saying that necessarily is one, but of course the way Streetcar factors in here, the play, of course, and later the movie, All About Eve. I love those references. And there's a huge homage to Opening Night, the John Cassavetes film with Jenna Rollins that I like a lot. That whole storyline of the son going to get an autograph and the accident that happens, completely taken from Cassavetes there. So, again, not a surprise to see Almodovar playing with a lot of his influences there in the film. Check it out if you haven't seen it yet. And up next week, we will have a discussion of 2002's talk to her.
Time for one last quick break. When we return, we take a turn on the casting couch and name our top five up-and-coming actors.
If it bends, it can break. Metal shakes. Standing at the door with a meal of your thumb. Pushing one. Waiting to be weightless. And the air inside your car has been breathed before. And the numbers on the wall never lie.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
It's a light week this week, Maddie, for new DVDs that are coming out this Tuesday. Got to start, though, I think, with Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. It's a two-disc special collector's edition, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff and extra features. A movie we did both like. I know I said it was maybe a little bit overrated because a lot of critics really did swoon over it. I don't think it's fair to say that we swooned over it, but we did like it. Definitely a movie worth checking out. Also, Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. This is the unrated extended edition. Film Spotting confession, I've never seen Harold and Kumar.
No way. No. Obviously tying in with the release of Harold and Kumar Go to Guantanamo Bay, which I will be at opening night.
I saw the trailer for that movie finally, and it looked funny.
Yeah.
I got to say, now.
You've never seen this?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you've got to see it.
Well, now
I will. Neil Patrick Harris is hilarious.
Everyone says that, I know. So I will finally check out Harold and Kumar now that it is out in that unrated extended edition. Also worth mentioning, the Bette Davis Collection, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 out now. Apparently, the first edition of this has already been released, and then they're tying in a couple new ones here, but movies like The Star and Jezebel and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, all out, The Man Who Came to Dinner, you can get those in the Bette Davis Collection, and you can get all the movies we mentioned here in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting movie store link at filmspotting.net. We're going to get to our donations. We have a lot of listeners we want to thank, very generous this week with their donations. But we have to mention this great contest, Maddie, courtesy of Spout.com. They are inviting Film Spotting listeners to recast the epic 1985 Kung Fu / Blaxploitation / pop star vehicle, The Last Dragon, at lastdragon.spout.com. Now, Maddie, you're giving me that quizzical look. You're a little bit confused. Growing up on that Minnesota farm in 1985, you were watching, you know, Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant movies you weren't apparently seeing.
I don't know. What is
The Last Dragon?
What is this Last Dragon?
Oh, I can't believe you haven't seen The Last Dragon, a movie I probably saw 100 times when I was 10 years old when it came out. Perhaps Kung Fu protege Bruce Leroy should be played by Mos Def, or maybe a hardened Lou Taylor Pucci, or would you take the role that one-hit wonder Vanity deified and cast it with an American Idol contestant, or Ani DiFranco? And if simply recasting The Last Dragon wasn't rewarding enough, Spout.com is going to select a winner for best casting, and it will be announced on Film Spotting next week. The winner is going to get some great swag from American Apparel. The contest will be judged, of course, with pure subjectivity. We'd have it no other way. Go to lastdragon.spout.com and get your casting agent skills on. I look forward to seeing what our listeners came up with and announcing it next week.
My mind is blown. Was that English you were just
speaking? It was.
I have no idea what is
Maddie,
going on.
Add The Last Dragon to your queue. Get it in there now. You got to check it out. Please enter the contest. Again, we will share the winner next week on the show. We may even throw out a copy of Walk the Line as a second place prize. We did get three copies of the new extended cut of Walk the Line, the extended two-disc special edition. It has 17 minutes of extra footage. We're going to share those with our listeners. And in fact, we want to throw out another contest right now. We're always looking for good poll questions on the show. Always a challenge every week. Right, Maddie?
Yes.
So the person who sends us the best poll question for next week's show,
They get the DVD.
They get the DVD. The one we end up using on the show, something that ties in with a movie that's coming out or something we're talking about on the show, the most creative, smartest, well-written poll question is going to earn you a new copy of Walk the Line.
Sounds great. All right, well, now it's time to thank everyone who donated to Film Spotting this week. Of course, every single penny thrown our way is appreciated, and we are humbled by each and every single donation. Now, we have a new system in place, and I think we should touch on this just a little bit. For every dollar that you donate, your name goes in the Film Spotting hat, and at the end of the month, which is what, 2 weeks away?
Yeah, coming up here.
We are going to review a movie of your choice.
It's actually every $10 you donate, but yes, what you donate will influence how many names you get in the hat, so
All right. Well, we want to thank those people that donated last week. Alexander in L.A., Michael in Laconia, New Hampshire. That's a gold donor. Kevin in Oklahoma City, Jonathan in Vernon Hills, Illinois, Brian in Austin, Texas. That's a Silver Club donor. David in Tulleton, Oregon, Ernst in Stockholm, Sweden. Our voicemailer extraordinaire, Greg Rice in Valencia, California. He's a Silver Club donor. Sean in Murrieta, California. Our Art House Marathon hater, Kevin Crossman, another Silver Club donor. Obviously, he's going to make us review Roadhouse or something
exactly.
like that. Cannot wait. Peter in Dundee, Angus, United Kingdom. Emma in Headington, Oxford, England. Thanks, as always, to our monthly donors. And also note, many of these are familiar names, repeat donors. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Also want to mention, okay, so you have one more week. Get your donations in. Get your name in the hat. And then we will do the drawing, and we will review a movie of your choice.
My name is Sophie. I'm 16 years old. I've been a gymnast since the age of 6 and a half. I was U.S. junior champion at the age of 12. I'm an only child. I don't know. What do you want to know? In another few months are the national trials. Last chance to qualify for the Olympics. I'm kind of like an Olympic hopeful.
Wow. That's really impressive.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. And Maddie, that was a clip from a young actress named Mia Wasikowska. And I wonder how many people recognize that name out there. She is the actress who portrays Sophie in this HBO series with Gabriel Byrne called In Treatment. Have you checked out any of this show, In Treatment?
No, you know I don't have a TV.
Okay, I know you have a TV. I don't know if you have HBO. But I bring up Mia Wasikowska here because she's an up-and-coming actor who did not make my top five, but who I felt like had a good shot. She's one of my honorable mentions.
What are some of her film credits?
Really, she has very few. This is her kind of breakout role, but she's so good. And I don't watch the show. It's actually, if you know anything about it, and apparently you don't, it's five different nights, a therapist with five different people who come to see him. I can't get into any of the other nights, any of the other storylines, but I believe it's Wednesdays with Sophie. She plays this young girl, as you heard there in the clip. She's a gymnast, and she has all these family issues. She's just amazing. I'm glued to those Wednesday nights whenever she's on. I think she's amazing. And then I heard her accent in real life. She's from, just like our listener Alex, from Canberra, Australia. She actually talks nothing like her character in real life, but she sounds so natural, pulls off the American accent. I just think she's really good and someone to keep an eye on a little bit here in the future. So an honorable mention for me. We're going to get into our top five up-and-coming actors, people who really aren't household names, here in a minute. But first, we did want to share our poll question, starting with our poll results from last week, tying in with our review of Michael Haneke's Funny Games. We said to you, I will see Michael Haneke's new version of Funny Games in the theater if I can, likely on DVD, or only if tortured myself. How did it come out?
The winner is, but not by much, only if tortured myself.
Despite our positive review.
At 37%. Close behind, likely on DVD. There's a ray of hope at 35%. In the theater, if I can, coming in only at 28%. Well, I mean, that's
a pretty even split. All about a third, obviously, but I'm a little bit surprised only if tortured. I thought maybe the DVD one would win out. It was very close, though. We do appreciate all the responses we got there in the poll. This week's poll question, we mentioned last week that we maybe were going to review 21, the new film about the MIT blackjack players, which actually is a really fascinating story, but I think the movie looks terrible just from the previews. And Kevin Spacey is in it. We threatened our listeners saying, if you don't come up with a good top five suggestion, we're going to do our top five Kevin Spacey movies. Thank goodness it didn't come to that. But we want to know what you think about Kevin Spacey as an actor. Maddie, 21-star Kevin Spacey is
an acting god, a solid actor, or a smug ham?
I wonder where you're going to go.
He is the smuggiest of the smug.
The smuggiest, hammiest
actor. Mr.
K-Pax
himself.
Yeah, we like him in K-Pax, though, with Jeff Bridges there. But I know you're going with a smug ham. I don't know. I think he's a smug ham lately, and he certainly hasn't done anything to really interest me of late.
Did you see that Superman thing?
I did.
He was terrible.
He's really terrible as Lex Luthor. I completely agree. For right now, I still may have to lead with a solid actor. I think of him from Glengarry as Williamson. There's a lot of equity there and the love for that movie.
Well,
and his
early on when he's doing the ref, he's doing Glengarry. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's sort of reined in. He doesn't look like the smartest guy on screen that he just seems to have to in every single movie.
Yeah, and I did mention a few weeks ago how I had this turnaround on American Beauty where I really hated Annette Bening's performance when I saw it again, even though I liked it at the time. I wonder if Kevin Spacey's performance holds up or not, one he won an Oscar for. Okay. Well, moving on from Kevin Spacey to some actors not who are overpraised, but some who are underpraised. These are some actors we consider up and coming. Maddie, did you have a criteria here for this list?
I did. I did have a list. Basically what I said is, all right, I'm a casting agency, and I want basically the next generation. Who are my stable of actors that I can put out there? So I had to get rid of character actors. Wasn't going to go that route. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go for anybody too big because I couldn't get them from the other agencies.
No,
you're
right.
There's just no way. So Pruitt Taylor Vance, one of my favorite character actors, too old. Bobby Cannavale, too big. I didn't include any of my best supporting actors from 2007, Paul Schneider, Garrett Delahunt, or mm-hmm. Toby Kebbell. But I did want to mention one that almost made my list. It's just that she's just a little bit too old for this list.
Okay.
And that's Viola Davis. You would know her from Steven Soderbergh movies. She plays Moselle in Out of Sight. And the only reason she might make my list, or she almost was going to make my list, she's a really accomplished stage actress, and I think she is wonderful, is that Isaiah Washington was also in Out of Sight in a really mm-hmm. small role. And then, of course, he got really big on that McDreamy series on ABC.
Yes.
And I'm thinking the same thing can happen to Viola Davis because I think she's wonderful.
You wanted to tussle. We tussle,
oh, yeah.
As J-Lo says to Isaiah Washington in that scene. Great setup there. For me, I just want to mention for my list, you really said it well there, Bobby Cannavale, too big.
Yeah.
That's where we're going with this list. If Bobby Cannavale, who we're guessing a good number of you out there listening right now don't know who the heck he is, if he's too big for this list, you know where we're going. For me, I had to imagine that about 99% of Film Spotting listeners will hear the name we're going to mention and say, who? You may even be familiar with them once you're reminded, once we give you their roles, but definitely not an actor you automatically place by name. And for me, they had to be young enough that you feel like mm-hmm. their career is kind of still ahead of them. Nobody over 30. I didn't decide that as a number, but it just turned out that nobody over 30 made my list.
Yeah, and really, I didn't go by age because a lot of actors, of course, struggle for such a long time and don't get their big break until the early 30s. So I didn't really rule out by age. I kind of mm-hmm. misspoke when I said that. But an actor like Viola Davis, she's just established. She's a really established sort of theater actor and career supporting actor. So she didn't make my list.
Can't wait to hear your number five.
Well, my number five is TJ Jagodowski. For five.
Who?
Yeah, well, there you go. For $5, you can check out TJ and Dave Pesquese in the TJ and Dave Show here at Improv Olympic in Chicago. It's the best.
Are you serious?
It is the best entertainment per dollar ratio in the country.
How many of our listeners can see that,
Quite
Maddie?
Simply, TJ is the best improviser I've ever seen. And for me, and I'm not being hyperbolic, it's like watching Picasso paint. It is someone at their top of their craft. He's landed a couple small parts in film in Stranger in Fiction. He played the dopey sheriff in The Ice Harvest. I don't know him. I don't know if he wants to do movies or Saturday Night Live, but if he did, I'd put him up for all the Tim Robbins roles. This guy really is phenomenal.
My number five will seem positively like a mega star probably compared to that, and it's Melanie Diaz, who we saw recently here in Be Kind Rewind playing kind of a love interest, but not really, to Mos Def's character. Her character in that film is Alma. I saw her in Dito Montiel's A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, but I'll be honest, that film from a couple of years ago, I don't remember her in the film. But she really caught my eye in American Son. Speaking of Iraq war theme movies that get it right, unlike Stop Loss, that's a film I saw from Sundance, my favorite film from Sundance this year. She plays the girl Nick Cannon meets on his way back to Bakersfield before he ships off to Iraq, and they develop a really nice romance. And then just a week or so after Sundance, that's when we saw her as Alma in Be Kind Rewind. And I think, unfortunately, she's not given much to do there. But there's a real sweetness and innocence to her, this amazingly cute smile. I really feel like she could play those innocent roles or be kind of a badass bad girl if she wanted to be. She's coming up in Hamlet 2, the Steve Coogan film that we didn't see at Sundance, but was the big sale this year. And she's at number five on my list because something I did try to do with my list is look at projects they were coming up in to see if, you know, there's some big stuff on the horizon. Her two biggest projects coming up, according to IMDb, didn't really grab me, Humboldt Park and Identity, but Melanie Diaz is definitely someone to watch.
Yeah, she's great. All right, well, my number four, well, Mr. Adam, I think you'll mm-hmm. recognize this guy, Jeremy Renner. I think this guy really has the goods. If I'm his agent, basically I'm pimping him out as the next Kurt Russell. I mean, you'd recognize him from Jesse James and 28 Weeks Later and SWAT. But I actually really liked him in North Country, which I thought on the whole was kind of a treacly movie. But it's really filled
He's the guy who gets on the witness stand.
Yeah, Bobby Sharp.
Yeah,
but it's filled with great supporting performances. Sissy Spacek, Dick Jenkins, and Jeremy Renner. I think he's the best of all three. And he's sort of like Kurt Russell meets D.B. Sweeney. That's what I'm putting him out there for.
Well, I think that's very well said. You have a future as a casting agent, Maddie. That is a good pick. I like him too, especially in 28 Weeks Later. My number four pick is Charlie Hunnam. He's really memorable as Bozy, the insane albino in Cold Mountain. I don't know if you saw Cold Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
But he's kind of the bad guy, in a way, in that film. And then he was the lead in Nicholas Nickleby, which I didn't see. But he caught my eye as Pete in a really bad 2005 movie reviewed here on Film Spotting called Hooligans, then Green Street Hooligans, where he plays the leader of this football club gang, basically who takes Elijah Wood, of all people, in and turns him into a soccer hooligan. It's a terrible movie, but he was an absolute badass with a lot of wit and charisma. I mean, he plays kind of a thug, but you could see that there was some intelligence there. And coming up, he's got some good stuff. He's in a movie called The Last Full Measure, not based on the Civil War book, but a Vietnam-themed movie with Bruce Willis, Morgan Freeman, Robert Duvall, Lawrence Fishburne, Andy Garcia, and Charlie Hunnam. And he plays the war hero character who's really at the center of that movie. And he's also supposedly one of the leads in a movie coming out that I really want to see. Supposedly Christopher McQuarrie from Usual Suspects is directing, called The Stanford Prison Experiment. And that might be an experiment some of our psychology majors are familiar with. You read about it in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, I think, where it's an experiment, you know, where they basically saw what normal people, when they're put into situations to be guards, like in a prison cell, you see how they react. So an interesting project coming up that he's in. A good actor to keep an eye on.
All right. Well, my number three, I've got a tie. I pulled an Adam.
You pulled a me.
I pulled
you
an Adam.
You chastised me today to a listener, and then you pull out a tie. I don't have any ties.
I couldn't help it. Brendan Fletcher, based solely on his work in Terry Gilliam's Tideland. I'm less familiar with his other work in Freddy vs. Jason, RV, and the upcoming Blood Rain 2, but he is lights out good in Tideland. He's really, really good, and one of the only reasons to check that movie out. And a tie with Sara Ramirez. Won the Tony for her performance as the Lady of the Lake in Spamalot. Now she's on that McDreamy Hospital on ABC. She is a force, and I really predict that she's going to make a name for herself as sort of the best friend Joan Cusack type, and then she's going to blow everybody out of the water with some small dramatic turn in an independent film that's going to win her an Oscar.
Really?
Predicted
now that
right
is
here.
A bold statement, Maddie Ballgame. Okay, my number three, maybe the most recognizable name here on the show because she got a lot of attention at the end of this last year, including here on the show, for the movie 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days, and that is Anna Maria Marinca, a Romanian actress. She's amazing as Otilia, helping her friend get an abortion in 1980s Romania. I'm not sure how she didn't end up on my Best Actresses of the Year list, because really she deserved to be in the top five, I think. And coming up, she does have a Romanian film that's set for release in 08 where she plays the lead, but I'm not familiar with the people involved at all. She is shooting a 2009 release called The Countess that's written, directed by, and starring Julie Delpy, and William Hurt's also in it, and Nikolai Kinski, son of Klaus. So that will be one to keep an eye on, The Countess with Anna Maria Marinca.
All right, well, my number two is Dallas Roberts.
He was hit by a truck, and you were lying out in that gutter dying, and you had time to sing one song. Huh? One song people would remember before your dirt. One song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on earth. One song that would sum you up. You telling me that's the song you'd sing? That same Jimmy Davis tune we hear on the radio all day.
I think this guy is just, he's an amazing talent. He's sort of the king of off-Broadway. You know, he's amazing in that revival of Langford Wilson's Burn This. He was the star of the film, A Home at the End of the World. Again, I don't know him. This is all sort of speculation, but I think he's another one of those actors that prefers the New York and the theater scene, and he's probably just going to absolutely nail and steal scenes as a character actor, you know, for the next 5 years. He sort of beat a notorious exit from the Glass Menagerie a couple weeks before it was slated to open on Broadway, and of course Christian Slater stepped in amid rumors that he quarreled with his co-star Jessica Lange. See, I don't think he's a Hollywood guy, but he is extremely, extremely talented.
You get all the acting gossip here on Film Spotting, courtesy of Maddie Ballgame. My number two, let's hear a clip.
Emily said 4 words I didn't know. Tell me if they catch. Brick? No. Or bad brick? No. Tug? Tug. Tug might be a drink. Like milk and vodka or something. Poor Frisco? Frisco. Frisco Farr was a sophomore last year. Real trash. Maybe had a class a week. Didn't know him then. Hadn't seen him around. Pin? Pin.
And that's Chicago native Matt O'Leary. He played the young Fenton Meeks in 2001's Frailty, the Bill Paxton film. I don't know if you saw that movie or not, Maddie, but I did. I never would have placed that. I had to look it up. But his first real role, the one that caught him attention, the one I certainly noticed him in, was playing the Brain, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's friend and, I guess, advisor in the great film Brick. I really like him in that role. And then he also stars with Melanie Diaz, my number five choice, in American Son. He plays Nick Cannon's drug-dealing friend, Jake, and he couldn't be more opposite from the Brain. He's this wild, loose cannon of a character. I actually had no idea it was the same actor. You'd never guess it until I looked it up later, but he's really a talented guy. Hope to see some more roles coming out from him.
Well, number one, there's probably absolutely no chance that I can land this guy at Maddie's agency, but it's Dan Fogler. He originated the Tony Award-winning role of Barfay on Broadway in Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Lugubrious, meaning extremely sad and droopy.
More or less, yes.
The topic I am all too familiar with. One moment, please.
Watch this technique. He calls it the magic foot. He's the only one I've ever seen use it. He spells the word out on the floor first so he can get a visual, then speaks it out loud.
Lugubrious. L-U-G-U-B-R-I-O-U-S. Lugubrious!
That is correct.
I know.
He starred, of course, in Balls of Fury last year. He's like Jonah Hill, only with range, and he stars in the upcoming movie Fanboys, which I think is going to make that whole cast sort of huge. It also includes Jay Baruchel, who almost made my list. It's going to be like super bad big.
Yeah, he's one of those guys from Knocked Up and that whole kind of Apatow thing.
Oh, Jay? Jay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. My number one is the actor who inspired this topic, Channing Tatum. He plays Steve in the movie Stop Loss, and I'll say he was going to be my number one, and I actually had thoughts about taking him off just because Stop Loss didn't do anything. He's Sergeant Shriver, Maddie, didn't do anything to really help his cause, but I blame that more.
He's like a beefed up Josh Hartnett.
A little bit, but I really think there's something there to him. There's more going on. There's more going on in his head than what you see with Josh Hartnett. I really do give him that credit.
Like a Stanley Kowalski kind of thing with
yes,
him?
Yes, basically. That would be he could play Streetcar, absolutely. That's a good point.
I could see that.
And he's really good as this troubled character Antonio in A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, another movie with Melanie Diaz, of course. And he's been on my radar ever since that film. And I was not so infatuated with him, though, that I was willing to check out Step Up or Step Up to the Streets, which he was in. But he's certainly an actor who now is getting a lot of juicy parts. Coming up, he's going to be the lead in Dito Montiel's next movie. It's called Fighting with Terrence Howard and Luis Guzman. And he's Pretty Boy Floyd in Michael Mann's gangster movie coming out, Public Enemies.
Ooh.
You got Johnny Depp as John Dillinger, Christian Bale's in it, and Marion Cotillard, and then, of course, Channing Tatum as well. And he's also going to be, I guess, the lead. He's Duke in G.I. Joe, the G.I. Joe movie that's coming out. He's going to be one of the lead guys in that. And he is supposed to be in the movie, along with Charlie Hunnam, the Stanford Prison Experiment.
No, so wait, is this G.I. Joe thing an animated thing?
It's G.I. Joe. It's a live action. If they can do it with Transformers,
Transformers
they're
kind
doing
of thing?
It with G.I. Joe. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is supposed to be in that film as well. So if you want to relive your childhood, all you boys out there, I know, Maddie, you're going to be in line.
Wow.
You can check out Channing Tatum in that film. Some quick honorable mentions I have to throw out there. Michael Ungaro, he's Sid from The Lords of Dogtown, and he's a main character in the movie Snow Angels, out now in theaters. Stephen Graham, I thought he might make your list. Combo from This Is England. He's a little old for my list at 35, but a really talented actor who's going to play Babyface Nelson in Public Enemies. So that's going to be chock full of good actors. And then I did consider Garrett Dillahunt, even though he's 44. I never would have guessed that. The sheriff, the deputy sheriff in No Country for Old Men, he is in The Assassination of Jesse James. And, of course, who I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, Mia Wasikowska, someone else to pay attention to.
You, sir, are an ageist. You are an ageist. He is more than welcome to darken the doors of Maddie's casting agency.
I feel like we're in a scene from Say Anything.
There we go. Well, those are our top five up-and-coming actors. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback at filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, 21, with Kevin Spacey and Jim Sturgis from across the universe. Run, Fat Boy, Run with Simon Pegg.
Is that Schwimmer's movie?
I think he directed it, yes. Superhero movie and Stop Loss, which we say, unfortunately, because we had hopes for it being this Iraq war movie, avoid it. Next week, we hope to review Leatherheads, the new movie with George Clooney and John Krasinski also in that one.
You know where John went to school?
I'm guessing Kenyon.
No, Brown University.
Okay, well, another tie to you there. So we're going to do our heist movie extravaganza. We're going to review Flawless, the new heist movie with Michael Caine and Demi Moore. We may also throw in a few minutes discussion on The Bank Job, which opened a few weeks ago in theaters and has been getting generally positive reviews. And then I think we're going to do our top five heist movies.
Very cool. Should be fun. All right. Well, thanks as always to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Dick Prawl and Authentic Records for this week's music. Learn more at dickprawl.com and AuthenticRecordsOnline.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAVideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net.
Okay. Hey, did you know the first known legal challenge of the Army's practice of stop loss was brought forward by Edward Stevens of the 1st Minnesota Regiment of the Civil War?
No.
Do you also know what the 1st Minnesota Regiment is famous for?
No.
For saving the day at Gettysburg. The second day of Gettysburg, they tell them you have to hold Cemetery Ridge. It's just 262 men against a whole brigade of Alabamans. They lose 215 men, 82% to this day. It's still the highest casualty rate of any one unit in the Army, but they held the hill. This was one of my favorite stories as a kid.
Okay.
Why I demanded to go to Gettysburg as a kid.
Really?
Yeah.